actual work literally says the stuff that isn't leisure. In Greek, it's the same kind of thing. The word there is askolia. The A means no. Skolia is where our word school comes from, and it means leisure.
Oh.
And those were the primary words that those societies and those language groups used to talk about the toil kind of work. It was the part of life that was other than leisure. So leisure was the primary category, and non-leisure had to be stipulated separately. Whereas for us, for the way this conversation has naturally unfolded, work was the primary category. And now we're like, oh, what's the not work? How much just in that is there perhaps an invitation to see some different paradigms going on? So I lead off with that, and then I ask this question, what's going on when we think about different kinds of not work? So on the one hand, one of the philosophers, a German philosopher, middle of the 20th century, a guy named Josef Pieper, his book will be on the reading list also. The book is called Leisure, the Basis of Culture, in the English translation. It's a little bit shorter of a title in the original German. And he's reflecting on, what does it mean? How should we be building or rebuilding our society? Do we need to worry about kind of baking leisure into the cake? Or is right now the time for, you know, productive work and building and efficiency and all those things? And that question of productive work, efficiency, building was an especially salient one for him. His book was published in Germany in 1948. So think about the history and the context and, you know, literally rebuilding a continent after a devastating war. And he's there in that time and place, trying to give a defense of certain kinds of leisure, even in the face of all the legitimately pressing needs that were going on in Europe at that time. Anyway, so like all of these books that are going to be on the reading list, there'll be about a half a dozen of them. These books are authors and ideas that I think are good to think with, if I can borrow a phrase. They're not all going to agree with each other. They're not all going to cohere with each other. They would disagree vehemently about various things. There is some major part in each of the half dozen of them that I disagree vehemently with. But I think nonetheless, either for the parts that I agree or for the reflections that the disagreement prompts, all of them are really good to think with. And the more that they unsettle us and challenge us and make us uncomfortable, while still being calm and reasoned and like able to talk, I think the better, actually, because that's the point at which we're going to reflect on our own thoughts a lot more. So anyway, Pieper calls one kind of not work idleness. And I'm just going to work with his term here. It's not the perfect term. But this is the kind of not work that really is defined in terms of work. It's like, okay, you can only push a body so far before it collapses. If you give me one day off every week, I can actually get more work done the second week than if I tried to go for 14 days nonstop, because I just can't keep going that long, right? Most of us can't, right? So there's the work that in that sense is, or the rest that's designed for work. There's the rest that's there to let me work more tomorrow or next week or whatever that might be. And so there may be in this kind of not work, and maybe it's the not work that I know is like, okay, I do need to like give my body a break. You know, I'm just too sore to keep stacking crates or whatever it is that I'm doing. But this kind of, there's something in this family, and I'm not sure what the perfect word for it is. I think idleness begins to capture it. There's sometimes when we're not working, a sense that we should be. A sense of, you know, what should I be doing now? What do I need? How do I get up and move? What do I get up and go? Is that a question or is it, I'm guilty?
Guilty.
we don't all have to raise our hands. It's okay. But this is a supportive group. It's, you know.
Excuse us.
Enjoy.
You're on stage now.
Right. Catwalk.
Such a well-behaved dog.
Yeah, no kidding. But we do have that sense of idleness sometimes, of like, I should be going. What should I be doing? What do I need to do now? There's a kind of what do you want to call it, a kind of anxiety about that not working, a kind of sense that I should be working. And so Pieper suggests to us that there are two hidden assumptions built into that anxiety. Like, we're not saying it to ourselves consciously, but it's what needs to be there. It's what needs to be true, if he's right, to make that anxiety make sense.
Here's us from the other side.
Of course.
No worries.
Have a wonderful walk.
Thank you.
We are. Thank you.
Good. Silver Week.
Good. Enjoy.
Come on, let's go.
So for that anxiety to be there, there are two assumptions that we might point to. He actually has more than two, but I think two are enough for us this morning. One is that all good things come through my agency, through my effort, right? Nothing good comes to me without effort, right? So if I'm not making an effort, nothing good is going to happen for me. Nothing worth... So this kind of labor theory of value that we mentioned at the end of the last stop is relevant here. But this notion that I am the only agent, I am the only actor, or maybe a group of us can be an actor together, but there are not other actors just letting things happen for me, right? Think about the difference, and by way of analogy, right? Think about the difference between what, like, a trained botanist out in the field as a botanist is doing when they're scrutinizing and they're examining and they're classifying and they're out there with their little hand lens, like, cutting apart a flower to look at the parts inside to be able to classify it properly, right? Botanists do all these things. There's a kind of outward-directed agency from me toward the world. But now think about just kind of sitting on the hillside, letting the breeze blow over us, letting the clouds drift by.
Stop and smell the roses.
So, but not even, but stop and let the smell of the rose wash into our nose. Let it come to me. I don't always have to go to it. I can sometimes be the recipient of the experience without initiating the experience. I can be the receiver without being the agent, right? It's at least conceivable to do that thing. I was laying out by my garden at the house where I used to live about 2 weeks ago, just needed a 5 minute whatever, right? Laying there looking up at the clouds, and I first had the thought, boy, I know that there are words for all these different kinds of clouds. I wish I would, like, learn those and knew what they were. Then I just kind of mentally smacked myself and said, no, just enjoy them. Just let them be themselves and come to me. Right. So there's this notion that, you know, this anxiety about needing to work at a certain level might actually be denying the agency of other people, other powers, other things in the world, right? Denying that other sources could be where goodness comes from, where value comes from, and not only from me. Whether we realize it or not, something like that is baked into that anxiety. And the second thing I think that's baked into it is a kind of scarcity, a worry that there might not be enough. And so I need to make sure that there is enough. I need to make sure, and I don't want to say that always having that concern is a bad thing, right? If we're coming up on winter and there's nothing in the pantry and nothing in the larder and nothing in the checking account, I don't actually have enough. I really do need to make sure that before we get hungry, like, that there is food. So there's very much a time and a place to think about those kind of genuine needs. But there's an interesting question a couple of us were having on the walk up to this point about figuring out where that enough is, right? But that anxiety about, why am I not working? I should be working. What should I be doing now? Is perhaps to have a sense of scarcity, a sense of, well, there might not be enough if I don't make sure that there is. And it's to have this sense of myself being the only agent, which is maybe actually a kind of hubris, to think that I have all the power here, to think that good things couldn't happen to me as a gift from friends or from others in the world, from the gods, if such there be, from nature herself, if such there be, right? From friends, if such there be. I hope we have all of these things. It would be a much richer world if it were filled with all of these things, with friends and gods and nature and all the rest. All of them agents, all of them able to make things happen, right? Without my necessarily having to make them happen. Question, Marisa. Yeah.
Yeah, so this idea of the enough element. So part of me wants to say that there's a suggestion on one hand that in that sense, leisure is a luxury. But it feels like there's more going on. You're saying it's not, it is in one sense, but perhaps it's not. Maybe there's maybe more of a necessity or something else going
yeah.
on where it can't just be classified as a luxury.
Good question. I'd like to think about that word luxury, maybe. And I don't want to speak for you or for anyone, but I wonder if there are some strange assumptions baked into that word, luxury. We often, when we hear luxury, we hear it's a kind of it's the kind of thing that's not actually necessary. It's the kind of thing that's extra. It's the kind of thing that's over and above whatever. It's you don't really need those things, whatever that means. Going back to Plato, as one always should, and to the Platonic school in Athens, as one always should. This is a notion that's baked through and through Plato, but his successor, Proclus, who's the head of the Platonic Academy in the 400s CE, so like 800 and something years after Plato died, his school was still going. And remember, the word school means leisure in Greek, right? Don't forget that bit too, right? here, Proclus, summarizing Plato, says, where our good is, that's where we have our being. Where this notion of goodness has to do with perfection, completeness. Perfection for the Greeks never means cutting things off. Perfection means filling things up. Getting the word perfect literally means complete. In grammar, the perfect tense means an action that happened and now it's over. So I walked to the store. Implies that I got there and now I'm done walking to the store. Mm-hmm. That's a perfect tense, right? As opposed to the imperfect tense means I was walking to the store, but then I got lost. Or I was walking to the store and then I got hit by a bus. Or then I was walking to the store and then I stopped to talk to Marisa and totally forgot about going to the store. Whatever, right? I was walking, but I never completed the walk to the store. That's imperfect in the grammatical sense, literally, right? Perfect here, complete. Our completeness, our fullness, our perfection. What is it that completes us versus what is the bare minimum for us? And so I think there's an account of the human being waiting, lurking just off stage in the wings here, and we can gesture toward it, where just getting by is not to be a complete human being. It's to be a human being who got by as opposed to, not making it, which is better, right? I don't want to starve. I don't want to fail to meet those material needs. But I would suspect that certainly in this group who would take their Sunday morning to come on a philosophy walk, we all at some level share the intuition that there is more to living a full and complete human life than just meeting our physical needs. Right. If you didn't share that assumption, I'd be kind of curious why you're here, actually. I'm glad that you're here, but I can't imagine what would motivate someone to do this without sharing some version of that assumption with me.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's a fair move here. So with that in mind, right, I would say that this is to emphasize that there are things that are not material, like food, clothing, shelter kinds of needs, but that nevertheless are a necessary part of a full and complete human life. And that a human life that only had food, clothing, shelter, and nothing else of these sorts of things in it would be lacking, would be less than it could have been for the kind of creatures that we are, for the kind of beings that we are. And so does that make it a luxury or not? I'm not going to quibble about vocabulary. But does calling it a luxury say that it is not part of our good as human beings, that we all share, no matter when and where we were born, no matter our circumstances, no matter our social class, no matter any of that? These are things that are goods for all of us. So, let's contrast that notion of the idleness that's about what else do I need to be doing with a different kind of leisure, right? And the one that Paper calls leisure. And so what we're thinking about there is going to be just the opposite of that anxiety, right? It's going to be what happens when we don't have that, when we're not in that moment experiencing the anxiety to must get whatever to-do list checked off, must be productive in whatever way. It's what will come into that space. So it turns out that there's a custom in some of the Nordic countries, like Norway, Sweden, whatever, that on the winter solstice, like the dark, like and up there, like the winter solstice means something,
yes.
Even more than it does here, and it means something here, right? As I look at just how much more, whatever, right? On the night of the winter solstice, you know, if you're far enough below the Arctic Circle that there is a nightfall on the winter solstice,
right.
Which is not always true in that part of the world, on the night of the winter solstice, generally the woman of the house, but the homemaker of the house, will go back into the pantry, look around in the pantry and the larder, and then while standing in the pantry, turn toward the main house and shout, "We have enough." And at that point, once she has done that, the party, the festivity for the winter solstice begins. You're only able to have the party and really be in the mode of having a party and not like a fake plastic smile party once you've looked and seen that you have enough to get through the cold, dark winter, right? But once we have enough, then we celebrate. Then we have a feast. Then we have guests over and share our food and our stories and our songs with them. But that we have enough is the prerequisite to leisure. Right? And acknowledging to ourselves and saying it in so many words, we have enough. We have enough.
There's a word in Norway, koslik, and it, you know, as many words in the old, you know, doesn't really translate because it sounds like cozy.
Uh-huh.
And it is like cozy,
oh.
But it implies that it has to be dark and cold outside in order to feel that kind of coziness inside. And part of it is the plenty, and part of it is the fire with
sure.
the heat that you're, you know, and the part of it is the wool that you've got to wrap around yourself, and all those things, you know, come together
yeah.
for koslik, which is it's a very solstice thing.
Oh, that's great. Thank you for that. Yeah, and there's also a sense in which, like, I'm just thinking about the blanket here, right?
Yeah.
I love the feeling of being, like, bundled up in a nice thick wool blanket. I can't do that in July when it's 100 degrees out. That is not actually koslik
right.
at that time, right? I need the cold outside in
mm-hmm.
order to bundle in the blanket.
As a child, I remember having my mother make me a milkshake so that I could get cold and it was summertime and get in a blanket and get that feeling.
That's awesome.
Yeah. I was maybe 4, something like that.
I had a friend whose grandmother knitted him this blanket that it was like an inch thick, but it had massive holes in it between all the stitches. So it actually it let all the hot air out, but still it felt heavy. It was like before weighted blankets were a
right,
thing.
Right.
This is what his grandmother made like 25 years ago, right? Koslik. That's
yeah.
I love that word. Thank you for that. But this notion of there's a kind of celebratory rest, a celebratory leisure, that's only possible once we've moved through that anxiety. So on the one hand, there's the just literal knowing or trusting that we have enough or that there will be enough.
I think that's where the current frustration with the economic system lies, is because there are people that are working two or three jobs and still don't have enough.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
there are people that, and, you know, there are eight people that own, you know, 50% of the wealth, and, you know, they have plenty. And honestly, because I think there's this frustration because I think there is enough.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's where the frustration is. It's like, there's enough if people will distribute it fairly.
Yeah.
But people, it's not for lack, it's not for laziness. They're like working two or three jobs.
I hope.
And they still don't have enough. And I think that's where, it's just a really, I think people are super frustrated.
I think rightly. I hope nothing I've said implies some
kind of
character assignation.
It's just been this angst that's like kind of covering the world right now.
Yeah.
And
it's deliberate, right? This is actually directly related to what Amber is raising here. If you are in that place of fear, of anxiety, of literally knowing that you don't have enough, literally knowing where tomorrow's or tonight's dinner is going to come from, not knowing, right? If you are in that place, or even in slightly less precarious versions of it, I've got enough food for a week, but if I don't make it to work this week, we're going to be real hungry come Tuesday or whatever it is, right? When you're in that place, it's very easy to control you, right? It's very easy to manipulate you. It's very easy to make you do what whoever has the power to give you enough wants.
And it's interesting, there's this narrative, and I think about this concept of work, you know, as really, you're talking about, and how it even affects economic and political philosophies.
Sure.
You know, the unions, right? It's like, I think there's this whole pull yourself up by your bootstraps mentality in a lot of conservative circles, where it's like, if only you work hard enough and long enough that that everything will go. It's that just world theory that says, if I work hard enough and make all the right decisions, I'll have enough and good things will happen to me. Meanwhile, you know, if I'm a lazy beast, you know, then I deserve what I get. You know, and there's this narrative that somehow the poor are lazy.
And that,
in fact, they're
that
working
begins,
two or three jobs.
That begins with the Industrial Revolution. That we begin for the first time in the European in Europe and the European diaspora, which is us, to get the distinction between, quote unquote, the deserving poor and the undeserving poor.
Mm-hmm.
That distinction only began in England after the Enclosure Acts, after everyone was kicked off the land that they had been farming or herding on for uncountable generations, brought into the cities and expected to work 14 hours a day in a factory. And then, you know, either be unable to do it because their bodies gave out, unwilling to do it because it was obscene, whatever it might have been. This distinction between the deserving poor and the undeserving poor, which is still very much with us, that's where it begins historically. You go back another century in Europe and you don't see that distinction. What you instead see, and you see it happening in practice and not just in platitude, you do see it happening in practice. You see that, you see a very different interpretation of the biblical passage that the poor will always be with you.
Mm.
And you see the presence of someone coming into the town who has need as a gift to you who have more, because you have the opportunity to practice generosity.
Mm-hmm.
You have the opportunity to make a gift. And how unfortunate would you be if you were not able to give gifts?
Right.
Whoa.
So
whoa. But that's the mindset, right? And that's also part of how the original Saint Francis could get by on just showing up in town every second, third day with a begging bowl, and whatever slop the villagers dumped in, he would get a meal, and he knew he would, right?
Mm-hmm.
Good luck with that. Back to our first person holding that sign.
Yeah.
Right? But there's this notion, so there's the notion in a lot of ways about the, you know, the individual versus the larger structures that we're built in. There's a lot of interplay around those things, right? And so this is like, I think this actually, we might be able to interpret what's going on here through the lens of that first of the two hidden assumptions that I gave us. The assumption that you are the only agent. Morning. Thanks. That assumption that you are the only agent, and so whatever good or ill comes to you is only through your own power. So man up. I hate that phrase too. Man up and get the job done and earn it. The assumption there is that there are no other relevant actors, no other relevant agents besides you to your well-being. By way of analogy, right, this is not on the reading list, but I could add it. There's a wonderful sociological study done by a woman whose name escapes me because she wasn't on the list. But she's studying the psychology of gambling addiction in Las Vegas. And this book is fantastic. But one of the things she points out is just what a coup it was for the casino operators who employ the best researchers and the best psychologists to addict people to slot machines as efficiently as they can, when in the diagnostic and statistic manual of psychiatric disorders, compulsive gambling addiction became a disease of an individual and not a thing that these institutions were doing to you. It got them off the hook. It deleted their agency from the picture. It put all the agency in the individual. And so bring it back to paper, right? Acknowledging where the relevant agency is. Both the agents who are already present, able to bring good into our lives, but also the other kinds of agency that we have to, in whatever way, navigate and negotiate. There's that word again, right? But find our way through as individuals and as communities, whatever that means. Acknowledging all the different agencies that are present, right, is a critical piece of working our way through this. So, yep, yes, absolutely. I feel like there's one quick little note that I wanted to add here, and there might be another question, but so we have those two assumptions going on, those two pieces. And I will again just throw out as a historical trivia for those who were inclined, as we saw already at the first stop, right? There's so much kind of religious and theological history that's feeding our way into the way that we think about these things. And it's a much more complicated history than the kind of plastic cookie cutter version of it that our modern discourse is inclined to give us. It's much more nuanced, it's much more layered than that. But the quick thought there is that, again, going back to the Middle Ages, that kind of anxious not working, that working but feeling like I need to be working, looking for something to do, as opposed to like the restful trusting that I have enough leisure, that anxious working was considered, that anxious not working, that anxious I need to be working, was considered to be a sin against the commandment, keep holy the Sabbath. Because even if you literally weren't working in the field or in the mine or in whatever it was, if you had the anxiety of needing to be working, then your life was not structured as it needed to be. And it could be that you were being forced into that by your employer or by whatever sort. It doesn't mean that you are a failure. But you were considered not to be really doing the Sabbath thing until you were not working in a place of trust, in a place that was free from that anxiety. And so that was put out as the goal to aspire to. This is not at all rest in order to work. Do we need to book it because of the rain?
I think we should
certainly direct. Are there other questions or thoughts as we do that? This is maybe some food for thought for making some of these distinctions at least, and asking what underlies them, asking what's at work in them.
You know, one thing I keep running into again when I think about this is why do we have to have a distinction between working and somehow enjoying simply being present?
Things like, there's this saying sounds really trite until you think about it, and that's if you find something that you're doing in your work day in your life,
you know. And at the bottom of what we're talking about is this assumption that having to do stuff that will provide for our livelihood is somehow at some level not fun, and it's more fun, it's more pleasant, it's more real to be doing something besides that. And why can't it be the same thing? Well, you know.
Good. Here.
That's hard to really get to.
So is that the idea that work and leisure need not necessarily be opposed, but
no,
let me try this on for you. It'll be our segue to the third stop. There's two pieces to this. One is this distinction between intrinsic and instrumental goods, right? So leisure in this thick, rich, celebratory sense is the kind of thing that is for its own sake. It's intrinsically valuable, as distinct from things that we do in order to fill in the blank down the line. It may turn out in certain lucky cases that certain things get to coincide for that. In which case, it's an interesting question whether it's work anymore at all, if it's no longer instrumental. The other piece brings us back to the first stop. And the thought there, as we kind of stand up and start to move, is this notion that in that case, I choose it. I will it. I'm not doing it because someone else is making me, right? And so with that piece in mind, right? So think about the potter who works for herself, decides what to do, decides what to make, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, right? She there is going to be able to meld the two, if anyone is. Because there's a kind of freedom, there's a kind of choice, there's a sense of her agency being owned there.
Okay.
Does that help a little bit?
Yeah, it does. It does. Basically, look, I'm getting to